Hello and welcome to The Virtuous Life. I'm your host, Pat Odie Murray, and we're heading into the last month, technically, of summer. This is the first show of August, and we've been doing some pretty heavy topics there toward the end of July. And so we decided, you know, after listening to the show with Elizabeth Scalia, and when she talked about the virtues of baseball, what's another fun summer sport that we could maybe talk about in regards to virtue? And I kind of hack around at golf. I like golf. And my husband is a much better golfer than I am. I'll probably embarrass him, but he was the SBC champion a number of times when he was in Oak Harbor. So he played golf quite a bit. And I remember years ago, I mean, probably 20 or so years ago, I got a book for Christmas called Golf and the Spirit, Lessons for the Journey. And it was written by M. Scott Peck. And some of you, if that name sounds familiar, I never even Googled to see if he's still alive or not. But he was a kind of a really hot writer in the late 80s, 90s. He was a Christian psychologist. So he brought kind of his faith and his spirituality to everything that he wrote. So this was one of the last books of his that I had, where he actually talked about golf and the spirit. And so I thought, well, I'm going to look this book again. I mean, it's been 20 years. So I pulled it out and started paging through it. And again, he's not Catholic. He's a Christian, but certainly some of those Christian concepts. He talks about virtue. He talks about sin. He talks about mortification, kenosis. So a lot of commonalities with Catholicism that we share with our Christian brothers and sisters in that doctrine. So I don't even know if this book's sold anymore, but if you're a golfer, you will certainly find it very interesting. But I wanted to be clear that not all of his concepts are Catholic dogma or doctrine. But a lot of this Christian doctrine is common all the way through all Christian religions, and obviously Catholicism is a Christian religion. So I invited my husband. Hello, Professor James Murray.
Hello, Pat. I'm glad to be here. It's wonderful to be back and talk about my favorite game.
Yeah. So you've heard Jim before. He's come in and talked about music because he is a music professor at Lourdes University. We talked about music, and he also helped us with, I think it was at Hildegard of Bingham.
That was the music one. We also did
beauty
movies.
Music. No, we didn't do movies. We did music in modernism, how music changed over time. We talked about doing movies, but we never got to it.
I thought we did the show on...
what did we do? I don't know.
We do so many things.
Well, we talk so
straight.
Much at home. We so, did you know, the, we think we're doing
the,
a show. We're
the,
not.
We did modernism, I think, in movies.
And music.
The production code.
Oh, we did the production code.
Yes,
you're right. We did.
Yeah, we talked
See,
about that.
You remember.
Huh? I'm an old veteran here.
That's so, right. Yeah. So he's a, you know, he has, you know, I always say he has many talents. So today when we talked about golf, I thought, well, this would be interesting because Jim's played, gosh, since when?
Oh, gosh. It's been over 50 years, I think.
Yeah. So why did you take up golf?
I took up golf mainly because my dad played golf.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed like he enjoyed it a lot. And it was a game that appealed to me because it's a game that does not require other people. And I don't mean that in a social sense.
Right.
But I mean, you can go by yourself and play and everything's fine.
Right. You don't have to get a team together.
No, you don't have to get 11 guys or 9 guys or, you know, for baseball or whatever. You can just go out by yourself and play. And so that appealed to me, the fact that I could do it when I wanted, as often as I wanted, and things like that. It was a good game for someone who was independently minded, I guess you could say that.
Yeah. Are you, what do you think now looking back over the years was some of the greatest lessons you learned from golf?
Oh my goodness. You know, I think there are so many. I think it is the idea that in golf you are by yourself. Somebody once said, you know, golf is the onlyest game ever invented. It's just you. And I think what the lesson you learn is that when you hit the ball, you hit it. No one else hits it. No one else is trying to keep you from hitting it. No one is trying to make you hit it poorly. I mean, if you think of, that's what makes golf unique. If you think of the other sports, there's an interaction involved that's not there in golf. For example, in baseball, the pitcher's trying to throw it by you. As a hitter, you're trying to hit it. The fielders are trying to catch it. Mm-hmm. You know, there's that tension. In football, you know, you're running, but somebody's trying to tackle you, trying to keep you from running.
Right.
In golf, no one's trying to keep you from doing anything.
You try to take a shot in basketball, somebody's got a hand in your face.
Somebody's guarding you, right.
Yeah. Even, I was thinking about that with golf. That would be kind of funny to have somebody stand in front of you and jump around as you try to hit a golf ball.
Well, it wouldn't be very funny.
No, you'd probably hit them. Right. That's dangerous.
It'd be good for health insurance, but it wouldn't be very funny. But, So golf is a game where it's just you.
Mm-hmm.
There's no one to blame.
Mm-hmm.
If you hit a bad shot, you obviously, because of human nature, you do blame everything. Ultimately, it's you. And personally, I like that. I like the idea that I'm not dependent on anyone else. You know, if I'm a pitcher in baseball and I give up, you know, one or two hits, but my team commits errors and we lose the game, I've lost the game.
Right.
I can say I pitched well, but the team lost.
Right.
You know, in golf, if I go out and I play well, I played well.
Mm-hmm.
No one else gets the credit. No one else takes the blame when I play poorly.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, that was a lesson I learned, that you have to stand by what you do.
Mm-hmm.
And you're judged by what you do. Now, you can sit in the clubhouse after the round, before the round, and you can talk about, oh, I should have done this, or I might have done that, or this is what I'm going to do. But at the end of the day, you are what you do.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose there's some correlation theologically with that.
Certainly, you can, virtuously, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you can talk mm-hmm. a good game.
Yeah.
But if you go out and steal from your neighbor, mm-hmm. you're a thief. It doesn't matter how you think about it.
Right.
And in golf, you know, if you shoot 92, you shot 92.
Right.
I mean, there's no wavering about it.
He's talking about my last golf score.
I just threw that number out there.
I think that's, you know, and I will admit, I always thought golf was like, when I was younger, watching, you know, when it would come on TV on Sunday afternoon or something, it's like, oh, change the channel. This is so boring. I just can't watch this. This is awful. And I never wanted to watch golf. I never wanted to have anything to do with it. I thought it was, you know, kind of a dumb, boring game. And then I think it was, gosh, I can't remember. I was probably working at Cardinal Stritch. A friend of mine was the PE teacher out there, and she asked if I'd, you know, ever played, and I said no. And she said, come on, you might like it. And I thought, But I thought, well, I got to get to know people around here. So I went out and played, and you really get a different sense when you start playing it. And that's why this book that I referred to at the beginning of the show really, you know, he talks about that golf really is just a metaphor for life. It's the way kind of we engage life. It has a lot of the same things. And he says, and the way you play golf, if you're very self-reflective, you start to understand that's the way you engage life sometimes. I mean, to understand that. And so he talks about probably one of the biggest problems, or not problems, but misconceptions maybe of golf, is that we think of it as a linear sport, in the sense that, okay, you know, you get your little guide and it says, here's the tee box, and okay, it's 150 yards to this marker, and then into the green, and then the cup, boom, done. And he says, but it's the most nonlinear game around, because very few people can do that. And that really is a lot kind of what life is like. We think it's kind of a linear, you know, we get started, we get moving toward our goal. And sometimes we think it should be relatively easy.
Yeah.
But so often we get, you know, we get taken off the path. It's not linear in a sense.
Yeah, I can see what he's talking about there. You know, in golf, the standard is what they call par.
Mm-hmm.
And now par is set by a golf course superintendent in lots of different ways. A lot of considerations go into what a par on a hole should be.
Mm-hmm.
But it's basically considered the average score or the score a good golfer should get on
right.
a hole. But, you know, sometimes a par is a great score. It's a better than average score.
Yeah.
Because some holes are built in a certain way. And so it is nonlinear. I love the quote. There's a quote from a golf teacher, famous golf teacher, Harvey Pienick, who said, play around a golf with someone and you know them more intimately than you might from years of dinner parties. You know, this idea that golf reveals character.
It really does.
And it reveals character, I think, more than any other sport. Golf might be the only sport where you're expected to call penalties on yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't, it's one of the greatest sins a golfer can commit is to cheat.
Mm-hmm.
It's just simply, it's unthinkable.
Yeah.
And
I think that's one of the things I really come to appreciate about the sport and really like, because like you said, in other sports, other people are calling penalties on you. You know,
yeah.
A referee is calling a foul, a umpire is calling balls and strikes. But in golf, it is the golfer that calls the penalty.
For the most part.
I mean, there are rules people that will
yeah.
say, well, yeah, that, but you usually have to ask. I mean, you usually say, look, I did this.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah, that's how it works.
And so instead of just, you know, waiting for somebody to say, hey, you did something wrong, you can't do that. So you got to kind of know the rules of the game.
You have to know the rules, but even in a broader sense, the idea of character on the golf course, you know, I've played with people who have cheated, and I saw them do it. I know that they tried to shave shots.
Mm-hmm.
They've done things illegal. But that becomes who they are.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, now I know that person, and you understand people's, there's no better word, you understand people's character.
Yeah.
In a real way on the golf course.
One of the things that Scott Peck talks about in his book is this whole idea of, you know, golf is really about truth and reality if you want to play the game well. And I think that's the sense, again, of being truthful about the kind of golfer you are. And he's not talking about self-deprecation, like, you know, I'm not a very good golfer, but that you have to be truthful if you want to get better. You know, you have to be truthful about your game if you want to get better. And he says that's, you know, that's the heart of almost any sport. But, you know, he said you can say that, well, you know, that's just the way I hit the ball. Like, I think he gives the example in his book that when he started playing, what is it when a right-handed golfer, the ball goes right?
That's a slice.
A slice. He had a really bad slice. So he would just, instead of learning how to play a slice, you know, to correct that, he would just aim, you know, in really kind of goofy ways. And he said, you know, but then sometimes he wouldn't slice and then his ball would end up in a bad place too. So he said, it's better just to be truthful. This is a problem and try to fix it instead of living with the problem. You know?
Yeah. I've taught golf a little bit to mm-hmm. people. But I've often said that to people. I've often said, listen, you can fight yourself, and sometimes it's good to, if the problems are big enough. But at some point, you're going to view the whole game as a constant struggle to fix things and it won't be fun. You know, if the ball always does the same thing when you hit it, accept that and plan for it. Mm-hmm. And plan for it. And if the ball always goes a little right, aim a little left, and the ball will go in the center, you know, in the middle. So, but, of course, what happens when I say, aim a little left if the ball always
then
goes right,
hit it straight.
They hit it straight, yeah. And it goes left, and yeah. Then they look at me and go, well, yeah. You don't know what you're talking about. No.
And I think that's what he's saying, you know, that if you have the problem, try to fix the problem. You know, don't try to always accommodate it. Try to fix it. And I think that's kind of certainly what we talk about with, you know, courage in golf. The ability to take on reality, the problems of your game. It's easier to try to, you know, like he said, he used to run around his backhand. And he said, when he played tennis,
yeah.
And he said, the minute somebody figured out in the game that he had no backhand, he was gone. You know, he said they would keep moving him so far, yeah. And then pretty soon they'd slam one and he, you know, they figured it out pretty fast how to beat him. Yeah. But he said, you know, it took a lot of humility to say, I got a really bad backhand. And then to work on it because it takes a long time. A lot of practice in order to get better. And he says it's the same thing with golf. It's you try to set these things in place to work with, you know, with your, what you see as your frailty, like, you know, a hook or a slice, rather than trying to fix your hook or slice. And he says, you know, and in life we do that too. You know we have a weakness, and instead of working on our weakness, we try to make accommodations for it so it doesn't, you know, try not to affect our life as much.
Yeah,
instead of powering through or over, using kind of courage and fortitude to engage that and fix it.
Right. I mean, there's a quote from Seneca, the Roman writer, where he said, it's part of the cure to wish to be cured.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the beginning of your cure, is to want to fix yourself.
Yes.
And so that definitely applies in golf.
Yeah.
And I've played with lots of guys who are perfectly happy to play poorly because that's not their point in playing.
Right.
Their
right.
point in playing is camaraderie, fun, mm-hmm. getting out with their friends, fresh air,
right.
You know, walking 2.5 miles or 4 miles, depending on how much you, you know, exercise.
Mm-hmm.
They're not really concerned with what they shoot because that's really not the point.
Right.
And again, golf is one of those few games that we can discuss like this.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of philosophy. There's a lot of, you know, theology to mm-hmm. golf, so to speak, that you don't find in other games. Mm-hmm. People don't sit down, I don't believe, when they talk about football and talk about these character traits or this sort of thing. No, that's football.
It's you, a play.
You play yeah. football. You just yeah. play it. Whereas golf is endlessly concerned. Golfers are always talking about these deep issues, mm-hmm. personal issues. How can I confront this?
Uh-huh.
What, you know, okay, the hole bends to the right. Do I use courage and try to hit it over that corner and cut mm-hmm. off distance? Do I use prudence
yeah.
to keep the ball over to the side
right,
so
lay
the
up.
Second one is easier?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do I, golf is the only game that I know that, is constantly addressing these personal, I hate to say moral decisions, but these personal decisions
yeah.
that influence how you do.
And again, the golfer is the person who is responsible for that. I'm the one making that choice. I don't
Absolutely.
Have a coach saying, here's your play.
No.
Do this, run no. this play. As a golfer, I'm personally responsible for deciding, am I going to go for the green on this one, even though there's a sand trap in front of it?
Right.
And knowing that, you know, chances are I'm not going to get it there and I'm going to end up in the sand trap.
And it is so easy in golf, then, to take that example. Do I go for it? Do I, you know, what's the most prudent play? And just move that over into life.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's so easy to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about there's no coach to tell you what to do. You know, the professionals, of course, have caddies.
Right.
And different players rely on their caddies for different things. There are some players who discuss everything, and it's a decision between those two people how to play.
Right.
Other golfers follow Jack Nicklaus's famous quote, which is his idea. He always told his caddy, you have three things you need to do. Show up, keep up, and shut up.
Mm-hmm.
Nicklaus didn't want anyone to tell him how to think on the golf course.
Right.
So, in that situation, there might be some teamwork involved.
Right.
But for the most part, for the weekend golfer who goes out by himself,
mm-hmm.
It's you.
And even the final decision is always going to be the golfers. It's not going to be the caddies. It's not going to be the coach.
Oh, absolutely. The golfer has to.
Will always make the final decision on what they're going to do.
And we talk about this idea of courage or prudence or, you know, I play with so many young college-age kids who simply hit the ball as far as they can.
Mm-hmm.
They don't think much at all. They approach a golf course like a nail to be hammered down.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one way to approach the game. It's one way to approach life.
Right.
Just bowl your way through it. Overpower it.
Mm-hmm.
But oftentimes, those players who have that philosophy of, I'm going to hit it as far as I can, and then we'll see what happens.
Yeah.
Many times, they're not the lowest score.
No, and I think, I want to kind of, because I'm glad you brought that up, Peck talks about this in his book when he talks about flight, freedom, and power. And he starts, I love this quote. He says, once there was a chronically unhappy man who thought that he could live without limits. I wrote kind of in the margin here, virtue, knowing that limits are freeing. The idea again, that sense of, I talk about it a lot of times as being able to, it's a sense of temperance, to self-discipline. I know, you know, you're talking about these young kids. You know, I want to see if I can hit this ball 300 yards, you know, or hit it as hard as I can, but having no idea where it's going to end up, you know.
Yeah.
I just want to hit it far, and he talks about that there is this sense, and he talks about it a lot with young people, is that they just want to see how far they can hit it. This is a quote from the book. Adolescent males, enamored with the glory of flight, love to hit the ball just as far as they possibly can, but they have not yet learned great accuracy. And that's a great quote because what he says, he's saying that we love to do that because on a good shot, there is this sense of freedom when you see this ball take great flight and fly long. You know, he said it's like it's almost inherent in all of us. He says it's that part of that we long for free. I mean, we're built with free will, you know, and so the ability to see that ball fly out there, he said, really kind of touches into this sense of freedom in us. However, if we don't use prudence, obviously, and temperance, we end up with this kind of unbridled freedom that gets us into trouble.
Absolutely. You know, it's so interesting because with golf, as you age, you do become more mature in your outlook. And you mentioned earlier about being truthful to yourself. You become more realistic in what you can do. There's a golf course here in the area, into the Toledo area, that it took me several times playing it before I understood that it's the type of a course that you have to put the ball in a certain place to be successful. If you hit it too far, that's where the trouble is.
Mm-hmm.
If you hit it too short, there's trouble. But there are places, and you know, we can talk about the design of golf holes, mm-hmm. and how they work, but there are places on this course that you have to, if you put the ball, you can score very low.
Mm-hmm.
And I was playing it the other day with a young college-age kid who just bombed the ball all the time. and I would hit my little positional shots, and he would hit the ball far enough that he would hit it into trouble,
mm-hmm.
where, and then he would not mm-hmm. score well.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's a certain maturity as you age and you experience golf and you experience golf courses, just like in life, you mature. As you experience life, you understand, you know, there are some decisions to be made
and
do things right.
And the idea, I think, as we're coming into break here, is the idea that when we're talking about this, what ends up happening, and I think, you know, hopefully it comes with age, but I think it can come at any age if you really are trying to work on being a virtuous person, to have a virtuous life. You can understand that even that my will has to be tempered. It has to be disciplined. And so when I'm on the golf course, no matter how much I would love to just bomb this ball as far as I can go, the further it goes, the less accuracy I'm going to have, and I'm going to get into trouble. So, you know, the idea here is, again, this is just like life. There, you know, we always talk about you have freedom. Free to do, you know, God gave you freedom. A lot of people look at freedom as the church talks about freedom of indifference. I'm free to do whatever I want. The church believes that's not freedom because we don't know how to discipline ourselves. Discipline is so important, and that's the freedom for excellence, that I understand how to use my freedom for the good and for to accomplish things in a good way. And on a golf course, that will mean freedom of excellence is understanding my limitations and being able to discipline myself to accept that reality and then to work with it so that I can bring about a good result. So we're coming up here on break, and hope you're enjoying the show. Even if you're not a golfer, I think you can certainly understand what we're talking about here when we talk about what we do on the golf course. Certainly is a lot of times what we do in life. And we're going to be talking more about that and the virtues needed to, you know, bring to your golf game, or which is exactly what we need to bring to life. And my guest today is Mr. Jim Murray, Professor Jim Murray. He is a golfer, has been for a long time, and he'll be back on the other side with me to continue to talk about virtues and golf. You're listening to The Virtuous Life. I'm your host, Pat Odie Murray.
Jesus commanded his disciples to go forth and preach the gospel to all nations. This they did in word and in deed. More recently, the Second Vatican Council reaffirmed every Catholic's role in this great commission. In answer to this call, St. Paul's Street Evangelization has developed a unique, non-confrontational approach to this mandate, loosely modeled after the modern pro-life movement. We aren't like many other evangelists that are pushy and in your face. We don't stand and yell on street corners or force anyone to listen to us if they don't want to. Instead, St. Paul's Street Evangelization is committed to presenting a positive, passionately Catholic, and non-confrontational presence to a world hungry for the truth. For more information on how you can help, go to www.streetevangelization.com. That's www.streetevangelization.com.
Hello and welcome back to The Virtuous Life. Today we're doing kind of another little light, it's not really a light show, but I think it's maybe a little more fun, not as heavy philosophically, but it certainly is about the virtues, right? How do we live the virtues out in our life? But we're doing it from the perspective of golf. Now you may say, oh, golf, I don't even watch that on TV. I think it's so boring. I was the same way. And now I play and I'm glued to this. Well, I shouldn't say I'm glued, but, if there's a good golf match on, I'm watching it and I find it quite entertaining. I didn't, for a long time. But one of the things that I think I enjoy most about golf, is that it is about the golfer's character. That if you engage golf well, It builds character, just like if you engage life well, it builds character. And what we're talking about today is how do we see virtues at work in golf? So if you missed the first half of the show, I encourage you to go back and listen to it, because we talked about, golf really is about personal responsibility, building personal character. We talked about certain things in golf and the virtues related to it. And I'm not doing the show alone today. I have a guest, Professor Jim Murray, Mr. Jim Murray, professor at Lourdes University. I always like to give the college a plug.
And probably in the interest of self-disclosure, we should say that I am married to you.
Yes, okay. Yeah. I was just going to say, you are my husband also. So, and I must admit, I played golf before I met Jim, and golf was really one of the things that we so enjoyed doing with your parents. Your mom and dad were both golfers, and the four of us had so much fun on the golf course, and we even did little golf trips together, which was fun because they were married 50 years the year we got married. So they were older, and as we were married and playing golf with them, but always had a really good time with them. And I got to be a better golfer. I mean, I shaved a lot of strokes off my game.
Yes, you have. You've made a great improvement.
Because of Jim and Jim's dad and his mom. And I think that has a lot to do with one of the virtues that we talk about with prudence or docility, allowing yourself to learn from others. And that really means you have to humble yourself. And we're also talking, using some ideas from a book that was written, over 20 years ago probably now, called Golf and the Spirit by M. Scott Peck. He's a Christian psychologist, not Catholic, but Christian. But he brings a lot of the Christian understanding of weakness and strength and virtue into the book. And he talks about humility and mortification a lot, or kenosis, dying to self, dying to your will, and that golf really is about that, that you have to humble yourself to ask for help. A lot of people will never ask for help on the golf course. They're playing awful, they're shanking shots, they're doing all kinds of things. And if they're playing with someone who's better than them, they may never ask for help. I have a lot of faults, but that was not one of mine when I played golf. I wanted help all the time because I wanted to get better. In fact, I probably annoy you a lot because when I hit a bad shot, I'll say, "What did I do wrong?" And then you'll go, "Sometimes you just hit a bad shot, Pat."
Sometimes your muscles twitch in a wrong way, not yours personally, but anyone's.
Yeah.
That you have to accept that.
Yeah.
You're not going to play perfectly.
Yeah.
And because you make a few mistakes doesn't mean you need to overhaul your entire life's work.
Yeah.
And I think that applies to life sometimes too.
It does.
People will make a mistake and say, "Well, everything I've thought or acted upon up to this point in my life must be wrong because I've suffered a setback." Mm-hmm. And that's not necessarily the case. In golf, sometimes you have to simply say, "That was a bad shot," and you move on to your next one.
And I think Peck talks about it in his book by talking about kind of living with tension, that you're trying to become better, but you know you're still, you're going to have these bad shots, but that doesn't mean you're a bad golfer. He says it's living with this tension in life. And I see that in life itself. So often people just want to give up. I'm trying to live a good life and nothing seems to be going my way. Right. So I'm just going to quit living it. I'm going to quit doing this because it doesn't seem to be making any difference. And it's kind of like, things take time. You don't become virtuous overnight and you don't become a good golfer overnight. These are habits. And I think that's one of the things I loved about his book. He kept talking about practice. You can only change if you are aware of your problems.
That's the first step, yeah.
Yeah. And he says, once you're aware of it, then you can start to learn how to change that, and then you just practice until it becomes a habit. And that's really what we say about virtue. You cannot build a virtue in your life unless you know it's not there, unless you're aware right. that it's I'm not a temperate person, I'm not a prudent person. You know, once you come to that awareness, then you can start understanding, what do I need to do to build this virtue in my life? And once you understand what you need to do, you just practice until it becomes a good habit, as they say. And that's what virtue is.
And, you know, that's the importance of what we call in golf the driving range.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the best pros, people would be astounded at how many golf balls they hit on the driving range.
Yeah.
There are young golfers who are playing now that it's not unusual for them to hit 1,000 golf balls a day, 1,000 shots a day, not playing golf, just hitting the ball out into mm-hmm. an open patch of grass,
mm-hmm.
just to practice the correct thing.
Yeah.
And if you think about that and then ask yourself, how often do I practice, you know, a virtue in my life, mm-hmm. how I treat other people. How often do I practice that? Do I do that 1,000 times a day? If you did, that would become second nature.
Right.
You know, what we call in athletics, you know, muscle memory.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that you maybe...
It's the same thing with
maybe
will
be like
character.
A spiritual memory,
yeah, exactly.
or something.
Yeah.
You know, it
yeah.
becomes automatic.
Right.
You know, it's funny because one of my favorite quotes, too, is by a writer, a French writer, Paul Valéry. And he wrote, "We hope vaguely, but we dread precisely." And I love that quote because that's how I am in my life. When you ask me, you know, think ahead, what are the best things that could happen? I have a few ideas. What would be nice if this, mm-hmm. this. But you ask me, what's the worst thing could happen? I can tell you down to the detail what could go wrong with a golf shot. I better not. Oh, I could hit it over here and then I'm done. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, I'm very precise in my dread, but I'm very vague in my hopes. If you flip that around, if you begin to hope, or if you begin to look forward and plan your attitude and your behavior, if you begin to do that with great precision,
mm-hmm.
and then if you consider the bad possibilities kind of offhandedly and vaguely, if you flip that around, I think your life's, mm-hmm. my life would be probably a lot better.
Well, and I think, you know, Peck says in his book, he talks about, you know, that's kind of one of the things that is so engaging with the pros, because pros will still hit bad shots. And that's what they do for their life. I mean, that's what, you know, that's their way
yes.
they earn a living. And yet, no matter how much they practice, there is still going to be bad shots in there. So they have to learn to live with that tension and that, what he calls a paradox. And as we do in life. And we call that sin, you know, that idea that, and he jokingly talks about, you know, sin and, you know, that's a sin of a golf swing or whatever. But we talk about that in our lives as sin, you know, that we can be on a great path doing good things, but every now and then we're going to step in it, you know, and not to then say, well, I guess I'm just a terrible person. But, you know, thank God in Catholicism we have the sacrament of reconciliation. You know, you can go and say, this is what I did, this is where I messed up, and you get to start over again.
See, in golf, maybe reconciliation would be, you play through your round of golf. I'm just making
yeah.
this up now. You play through your round of golf, but then you consider what club you didn't hit well, and you go and you fix that. In,
mm-hmm.
in golf, you go and fix that by taking that club to the driving range and hitting
mm-hmm.
50 or 100 shots with that club.
Right.
That's how you reconcile your inability with what you want to do better next time.
Yeah. And Peck talks about the idea, too, that so often we don't own our goodness on the golf course. He said, you know, like when we hit a really good shot and we'll just say, oh, well, that was dumb luck. And I know we make the joke of, you know, the blind squirrel theory, because that
yes.
was your dad. Your
My dad,
had
that was
great...
one of his favorite quotes was, you know, even a blind squirrel finds an acorn once every winter.
Yeah.
And you know, that's kind of
an old adage.
An old adage. But, you know, the idea is Well, no matter how bad you are at golf, you're going to hit one good. You're going to hit some good shots.
Yeah, and so, but Pack, I think, does a nice job because he says so often. We say, well, we hit a good shot, and oh, well, that was dumb luck. That was just dumb luck, you know. But he said, the reality is, you actually hit that shot. The truth is, you hit a good shot. And he makes and he said, and you should feel good about that. But he says, dumb luck to him is you hit a terrible shot, but it has a good result. And I was thinking of this the other night. I was out playing and I went to hit a chip, and it was just an awful hit. And yet it rolled up, you know, within a one putt, you know. Mm-hmm. And he says, you don't feel good about that because it was still a really bad shot, even though it had a good result. And I think about that in life. You know, so often you can do the wrong thing, but end up with a good result. You know, it looks okay.
Well, the end justifies the means.
Yeah,
isn't
no, it
that
doesn't.
Right?
No, no, it doesn't. Not in virtue. And so that's what I think he's getting at here. That even when you hit a bad shot, even if it ends up in a good lie or a good place on the, he said, you still shouldn't feel good about that because that was dumb luck. That
right.
wasn't a good shot.
Yeah.
He says, but when you really hit a good shot, you should feel good about it and you shouldn't say that's dumb luck because the reality is you hit that shot.
Yeah, that comes with maturity too.
Yeah.
That's something that it took me a long time to understand how you could go out and lose a match, lose a tournament, and yet still look at yourself and say, I played well.
Mm-hmm.
That happens to me all the time. I don't often win things, but I'm able to, you know, with some effort, I'm able to look at myself and say, I played well. You know, I didn't do anything wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Other people just did things a little bit better.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with that. Jack
right.
Nicklaus said, the reality is people don't win tournaments nearly as often as other people lose them.
Mm-hmm.
You do what you can do. Other people just simply make a few more mistakes, and you end up as a winner,
mm-hmm.
but nobody's perfect.
Right.
You know, the winner is not the person who's perfect. The winner is the person who manages their mistakes the best, and I suppose that's true in life too.
Well, and I'm going to talk about penalties in golf. These like unplayable.
I'm an expert.
Yeah, because unplayable lies. Now, this is something because I'm still learning stuff about the rules of golf. You know, because we've been going out, me and you, and our great nephew who plays golf and plays for St. John's, and we've been out playing and. And so you and he are talking about rules a lot, so I learn a lot of stuff, because I'm never going to play in a tournament. I'm never going to do those kinds of things. I do it strictly for exercise and self-discipline. But you guys were talking about an unplayable lie. I didn't realize that you could call an unplayable, like I as a golfer, if I'm in a bad spot, can just say, this is an unplayable lie. And I don't have to hit it from
there. I've always thought the unplayable lie rule is one of the most interesting rules in golf, because it's basically, it requires you as a golfer to look at your position and evaluate your position, evaluate what you can do in that position, and at some point it might be better to take a penalty to improve your position.
Yeah.
You know, the unplayable lie rule basically says that you can declare where your ball sits as unplayable.
Right.
You can then take a stroke penalty and move it two club lengths, no closer to the hole, and put it there, and then hit it on the green, or hit it wherever you want to hit it. And
or can you move it back, too?
You can move it anywhere, two club lengths, as long as it's not closer to the hole. So, and theoretically, the rules don't say when you can do it.
Mm-hmm.
So you could take an unplayable lie at any point. Even if your ball is out in the middle of the fairway, theoretically, you could take an unplayable lie if you think it will improve your angle mm-hmm. or your final result.
And I find it interesting because Peck was talking about the idea of, I think he was talking about being in a sand trap under a lip or something.
Yeah.
There was like no way he could hit it. But by golly, he was going to try.
You know, yeah.
And he said, he swung like five times. And the ball never got out of the sand trap because it was right under the lip. He said nobody. He said only God could have gotten it out of there. No golfer could have gotten it out of that lip. But he was too proud. And he didn't want to take the penalty. You know, he didn't want, because taking penalties, not hitting a shot where it lies, he says, always meant to him weakness. You know, I'm being weak, I'm whining, I mean, you know, and he said where he'd have been much better off had he declared an unplayable lie and moved it back in the sand trap, because he couldn't get it out of the sand trap, but moved it back in the sand trap where he would have had a decent shot on the group,
right.
You know.
The unplayable lie idea is all about self-reflection. It's all about looking at your ability, looking at what the possibilities are, and picking the best route forward. Sometimes the best route is to take a penalty.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing, you know, there's nothing inherently wrong with taking a penalty. But what I like about it, like I say, is it brings in this whole idea of self-reflection,
mm-hmm.
this whole idea of I have to evaluate my situation here. And rather than continue flogging away, golf spelled backwards mm-hmm. is flog, flogging away at an untenable situation,
oh.
maybe it would be better for me to step back, reset,
mm-hmm.
you know, with that
right.
one-stroke penalty, and then start fresh.
Right.
And I think there are a lot of things in life like that.
Yeah.
A lot of times people will get themselves in a situation and their solution is to just
do it some more.
Right. Just you know, just keep hammering away at it with very little hope of success, when maybe their best route would be to step back, take a couple steps off to the side, and move forward in a slightly different direction.
Yeah, I just want to read this from this book, because I think this is a great way to talk about this, how golf and life intersect here, because he talks about people hating to take penalties. They'll do anything, and then they'll end up in a worse place than they were before. This is what he says. We have come to a sort of spiritual principle. When you are in a situation on a golf course where it seems a toss-up whether to hit the ball or to submit to the humiliating penalty of declaring yourself to have an unplayable lie, you will be better off taking the unplayable lie. It may seem like a cowardly choice, but it is really a very old principle that is summed up by the Apostle Paul's words, in weakness, strength. I love that, because he goes on to say, St. Paul's motto, in weakness, strength, sounds particularly bizarre in our culture, which almost worships temporal power. And I think, I love that, because he says, you know, so often we look at, I'm going to take this penalty as a cowardly thing or a weakness. But he says, it really takes a lot of guts to admit you're in a place that
you can't get out of.
You can't get out of. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so he said, and I, in fact, I wrote fortitude in the margin here. The idea that it takes guts to say, I can't do this. This is literally impossible for me. So, I'm going to, like you said, step back. And in golf, we take a penalty, a one shot penalty, but in the end, we might have a better score than had we just tried to keep hacking away at it. And that's kind of the way I think this spiritual courage that he's talking about is really important in golf.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, knowing the rules in golf is important, because then you understand your options of how to remove yourself from trouble.
Yeah.
You know, there are water hazards. There are lateral water hazards, each of which give you multiple options to get yourself out of trouble. And I think in life it's the same thing. And I think that's what faith in life does, or knowledge of your faith. You understand all your options.
Right.
You understand where your strength lies. You understand all the different avenues you have for people to help you and things like that. It's the same thing as knowing the rules in golf. You need to know what your options are.
I want to kind of, as we're getting closer to the end, I want to kind of look at the idea of anger, disciplining will, you know, because obviously he talks about, in the book, he says, anger is the golfer's greatest enemy, and blame is part of that. He says where you will blame the hazard, you'll blame everything except yourself.
I think we hit upon that early on in the show.
Yeah. But anger, I think, is, he said, you know, it's the world's, you know, it's the golfer's worst enemy. What do you, you know, when you think of anger?
The problem with anger is that it feels so good to release it. You know,
right.
It feels so wonderful to release it. There's a quote from Henry Longhurst, who's a famous British writer on golf. And he wrote, "The most exquisitely satisfying act in the world of golf is that of throwing a club. The full backswing, the delayed wrist action, the flowing follow-through, followed by that unique whirring sound, reminiscent of a flock of passing starlings, is without parallel in sport." And I mean, that's the problem with anger. It feels so good to release it, to throw it at somebody,
right,
or throw it at your club, and it requires great self-restraint to
discipline. Yeah.
To discipline. Now, Tommy Bolt was probably the most famous angry golfer and a professional. He was a golfer in the 50s and 60s. And he said, when Arnold Palmer first came on the tour, Tommy Bolt said, "I saw him throw his clubs backwards."
Hmm.
He says, "I taught him to throw them forward so he could pick them up on the way to the towards the hole." I suppose all golfers have seen anger on the golf course. It was probably the number one thing my father taught me that he absolutely would never tolerate,
mm-hmm,
is any display of emotion.
Mm-hmm.
On the golf course, even like, look at me, how good I am,
right,
kind of thing. But particularly anger, because he taught me early on that when you see that in another golfer, you have seen their biggest weakness.
Mm-hmm.
And if you just continue to play calmly and you know that when they experience a hardship, they are going to
lose it.
That's the greatest advantage you can have on a golf course.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I've seen men throw their bag of clubs in ponds, which is expensive.
Yeah.
I remember a young golfer I grew up with who would hit a bad shot and walk over to the nearest tree and put the club around the tree with both hands, mm-hmm, and just twist it a bow tie around the tree. But I knew playing in matches against those types of players, I mean, that gave me extraordinary confidence. Because,
mm-hmm,
I knew, you know, as in life, you know, when you work from a position of anger, you're not going to improve your situation.
No.
Probably going to get worse.
Right.
And how it is in golf.
You've just created another issue that you have to deal with.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
And that's, yeah, you're right. That's the way it is in life.
Yeah.
Well, before we close out the show, I do want to touch on something that Peck talks about, which I found extremely entertaining because it's me. He talks about how eagerness can be not necessarily a virtue, but it can also be a vice. And so I love the way he talks about eagerness, because he says we tend to think people who are eager, you know, have all this liveliness and, boy, they're ready to go at it. But he said the problem is that, again, there is a paradox with eagerness, that eagerness can also work against you. Because, again, if you're not disciplined, your eagerness can create all kinds of issues. And so when I thought about it, he uses the line, let's see if I can find it here real quick because we're getting to the end of the show. Paradox of eagerness. Failure to deal well with this paradox is responsible for far and away the two most common mistakes in golf: hitting the ball too hard and looking up too quickly. to see where your ball is going. I wrote in the margin, I do this. Because he says when you swing too hard, you lose your balance. When you lose your balance, you hit a bad shot. He said you can either top the ball, whip the ball. All these humiliating things come into play. And so he's saying that that idea of eagerness, which is kind of a part of human nature, again, without the discipline and the prudence, the knowledge to know that, yes, I want to see where my ball is going, but it won't go anywhere unless I keep my head down.
That's right.
And so I saw that and I thought, boy, this is, this kind of sums up, it's kind of these two rules, but the idea again, he said you don't want to get rid of eagerness, but you want to discipline it. So we keep coming back to this concept of discipline.
Yeah.
The golf really teaches you discipline.
Yeah, it certainly does. And it's like I said earlier, it's that's why I think it is the best game. Because it is such a personal game. It's so dependent on character. And it reveals so much about your outlook on life.
Yeah.
There are people who can play golf with a smile on their face all day, and those are people who are happy.
And I think that the idea of, you know, we've been talking about personal responsibility, discipline. A lot of times those sound like, you know, words that aren't too fun. You know, what do you mean? You know, but I think we see it so easily sometimes when we're in sports. I try to get my students to be, especially my athletes, to understand that is exactly the same thing discipline does for us in life. It's not like, you know, I have these limitations and boundaries that discipline me so that I can become better at a sport. It's the same thing with life. I have discipline. I have boundaries and limitations in life that aren't limiting, but are freeing to help me to become a better person in life, a more virtuous person. So we are at the end of the show. Thanks so much, Jim.
No problem. Glad to
talking
glad
about
to
the virtues of golf.
Yes, I'm going to go out and play golf.
Okay. Yeah. We're going to keep working on being more virtuous all summer long.
Yes, discipline not of the body, but discipline of the mind.
There
is the
you
key.
Go. Right. Well, thanks so much for listening to The Virtuous Life. I hope you've enjoyed this show on virtue and golf, and we'll see you next week. You're listening to The Virtuous Life. I'm your host, Pat Odie Murray.